For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, last week we were in Mark 1 to 13, which is just sort of the prologue, as Mark says in verse 1. It's the beginning of the gospel, and some foundation work is being laid there. John the Baptist comes on the scene in fulfillment of the prophecies in Isaiah chapter 40 and in Malachi chapter 3, that before the coming of the great king, the Messiah, there would be this forerunner who would come and announce his way. And that's what John the Baptist does. In a real sense, we could say that John the Baptist is the last of the great prophets of the Old Testament era. And he, in baptizing Jesus, he essentially is a coronating him as king. And Jesus, through his baptism, is identifying with the people that he has come to save and to rescue from their plight. And then in very, very rapid succession, all the way through chapter 2, Mark walks us through the second year of Jesus' ministry. And it seems like every other paragraph in that section begins with the word immediately, and just trying to capture the sense that everything's moving fast, that God's at work, and look at the things that God is doing, and come on board, get involved with that. So we'll see a little bit of that this time, and the next time we're in chapter 2 as well. But what we want to understand here tonight and kind of get at is the idea that Jesus, through the things that he's doing, and which we'll begin to describe here this evening, is really establishing his authority as King Messiah. And this is the thing that people are really transfixed by him, that they see him doing things that normal human beings can't do, that surely these are things from God himself. And the reaction, the response in each of the cases is a sense of amazement that God has moved in history the way he has, that God is calling on people the way he does, that God is speaking with such incredible clarity and is doing things that demonstrate that God has in fact come on the scene. And so it's kind of an exciting series of scenes, I think, in this section. Let's just take it from the top, where Mark more or less summarizes Jesus' ministry. It says in verse 14, later on, this is after the baptism, after Jesus goes out into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. It says, later on, after John was arrested, and that's going to be an important phrase that we'll come back to, Jesus went into Galilee where he preached God's good news. That's the gospel. Gospel just means good news. And the content of that message, verse 15, that the time promised by God has come at last, he announced. The kingdom of God is near. Repent, or that is to say, turn from your sin and believe the good news, that God has forgiveness, that God wants to have something real going with you in your life. And that's the central message of Jesus Christ. It is the good news, and the things that Jesus does and the things that Jesus teaches in all of these great scenes all the way to the cross is nothing more than simply an illustration of this is what the good news is. And this is what it means to respond to that good news. And so tonight we're going to look at three ways that he presents good news, and the amazement that is dawning in the hearts and minds of the people who are there, and the really sweet benefit that Jesus is offering. So let's take a look. This is the first scene, verse 16. It says, one day, as Jesus was walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew throwing a net into the water, for they fished for a living. And Jesus called out to them, come, follow me, and I will show you how to fish for people. And they left their nets at once and followed him. And a little further up the shore, Jesus saw the Zebedee boys, James and John, in a boat repairing their nets, and he called out to them at once. And they also followed him, leaving their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men. And so here is the first kind of picture of the attractiveness of Jesus Christ to these people. And the first is an illustration of the attraction of purpose in calling these guys into this close relationship called discipleship. Now, the first time I read this account many years ago, and I guess I was probably influenced by those 70s and early 80s movies about Jesus. And maybe you've seen some of those movies out there. I forget their titles, but you know, where you got this blue-eyed, long-haired, hippie-looking Jesus, and he's just got that hairy eyeball gaze, you know, and that's what I thought was like going on here. Here's Jesus trudging down the mountainside, and he sees these guys, and he gives them the hairy eyeball, and they're like, "Yes. Yes, Master, I will follow." You know, and it kind of, because it's moving so fast, it gives that impression. And I want us to understand that that's so totally not what's going on here. There's an important chronological reference, in fact, in verse 14. I read it from at the top, that said that after John the Baptist's arrest, Jesus went out and he was speaking this way publicly about the good news. And that's an important chronological reference point for this calling on these four guys to join him in his work. Because if we correlate all four Gospels, and that's sort of the value, I think, of having four Gospels, you can see what's going on and the specific references that are given in one Gospel, and you can correlate that with the narrative in the other Gospels, and especially what we find in John chapters 1 to 4 is that Jesus has been involved in public speaking and engaging with people about himself and about this good news of the gospel for a whole year before the time of Christ's arrest. And that becomes important because John adds information that Mark does not, namely specifically that Andrew and Peter, the first guys who Jesus comes and says, "Come follow me," are people who are closely associated with John the Baptist. Andrew, Simon's brother, was in fact one of John the Baptist's close associates, a disciple. And so here's Andrew, and through Andrew to Simon, who's later called Peter, they have John's explicit testimony in John chapter 1, verses 35 and 36, where John sees Jesus and he says, "Behold, this is the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." And he just like releases his own disciples and says, "You know, you guys go check this guy out. You go listen to him." And so for the better part of a year, these guys are a part of a fairly broad band of people. In Luke's gospel, a little bit later than this, there are as many as 70 people who are in a fairly ongoing, regular way, sort of following Jesus, shadowing him where he goes, and they're just into what he's doing. They're trying to learn what he's teaching. But these guys were among that number. And so the scene that we read in Mark chapter 1, this is not the first encounter Jesus has with these guys. It's not like out of the blue he just says, "Hey, come follow me." They've got a context because they've heard what John the Baptist had to say. They've been following him around. They've seen him at work. And so now Jesus is saying, "Okay, you've gotten a taste of what I'm doing, of who I am, of what I'm about. And now what I want to do is invite you into something a little bit more rigorous, a little bit more focused and concentrated." And that's what this is really all about. He says, "You come and follow me, and I'm going to train you. I'm going to teach you a skill, an art. I'm going to, instead of being fishers of fish, you're going to learn what it means to fish for people." Now, the significant thing about this, and this is not unanalogous in the ancient world, masters, rabbis, religious teachers, they almost always had their disciples, the people who would follow them around. But always, in the ancient context, it was that you knew of a rabbi's teaching, And you thought, well, I'd like to get more of that person's time. And so you kind of, you approach them and you sign up. And you want to learn, you know, what their take on the law is. And you want to learn from them and so forth. But what makes Jesus so different is he's the one who's taking the initiative. And he is choosing people to join his inner circle. And he doesn't say, come follow my teaching. He says, come follow me. And that is just utterly without parallel. What Jesus is saying is what's important is me. That my teaching and the things that I do point back to who I am and what I've come to do. So that you can't separate Jesus' teaching and Jesus' actions from who is Jesus. He says, you come and you follow me. And so there's a unique authority that's being established here. It's not another school of Jewish thought or something like that. It's all about following this man, Jesus. And they're called specifically into relationship. Here are guys who for 2.5 years are going to be following Christ around. They're going to be eating together and they're going to be just doing life together. They're going to see Jesus up close. They're going to see how he interacts with a really wide spectrum of people. They're going to be listening to his teaching. But it's not like, you know, he's the master and they're the pupil in the sense that they come with their steno pad and they're like, okay, Jesus, lecture. And, you know, I'm taking my notes and stuff like that. It's that they're doing life together. And this really is God's way, because at the end of the day, what Christ has come to do is offer a relationship between alienated people and their Creator. It's all about the relationship. And so as Jesus is training these people to take that message out, he wants them to understand that at the core of it is not just merely some abstract philosophy or creed. Although, of course, truth matters. We'll talk about that in a minute. But at the core of it is a relationship. And what is God really like? And what does it mean to be a godly person in the wide range of activity that we find ourselves in? Well, it's a matter of really following the example of Christ. And so that's what they're learning. What does God think about this situation? Man, if God were here, how would he respond to this person or to this problem? And that's what these people were learning as they followed him. They cultivated relationship with him. There's just really cool sort of intimate give and take that exists between these disciples and Christ. You know, Jesus, people have different images of him, I suppose. You know, some people kind of view him as the stoned out mystic or whatever. Whatever that image might be, one of the things that the Bible would include is the idea that Jesus was a funny guy, that Jesus had unique relationships with each of his disciples. He had nicknames for him. Simon had a nickname. He was nicknamed Peter, which means the rock, you know. And when you think about rock, what do you think about? You think about stability, right? Well, you know, Peter was anything but stable. Peter was a pretty fluid character, and he usually had his foot in his mouth, and he was, you know, he's just all kind of screwed up. But Jesus had this vision for him, and he knew what he would become, and so he just calls him the rock. And so it was with the other disciples as well. John refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved in some especially close kind of way. And so you have this kind of relational thing going. And I think that's an important piece here. What Jesus is really putting before these guys is, hey, you've been around. You've heard me speak. You've been at parties with me, like the wedding in Cana in John chapter 2. You've seen me perform miraculous things. So you've seen some things. Render a verdict now, and do you trust me? Do you trust me with your life? Are you prepared to engage with me in a relationship, the future of which I have not told you? I'm not telling you where this is going. All I'm saying is, I'm going, and will you come along with me? And so this issue of trust becomes an extremely important one. That's really at the heart of what it means to be a follower of Christ, is that I am prepared to place personal trust of my life in the person of Christ. For these guys, it meant leaving their fishing and moving on. That's not certainly the way it is for everyone, and Jesus is not down on fishing. But the question is, are you available for whatever that might be, for me to call on you to come follow me? Do you trust me? Big deal. And in the context of this trust relationship that is going to develop over the next year and a half or so, there is a tacit learning process that's going on. And they, again, they're seeing Jesus at work. They're seeing how he interacts with people. And really, the Christian living is an art. It's an art. It's something that we learn. You know, in our technological society, mostly the way that we learn is just by absorbing as much information as possible. We're a knowledge-based culture, right? Well, that's okay, but that's very far removed from the idea, so central really to the biblical world and to biblical teaching, that living is an art, and that to be adept at living and the art of living requires sort of the master-trainee relationship, where you are learning skills that you can't get in a classroom. You're seeing the master at work. You're seeking to imitate what the master is doing. You make mistakes. In the case of these guys, you make a lot of mistakes. In the case of a lot of us here tonight, fairly embarrassing mistakes. And that's all a part of the learning process, because the question is not success or failure. The question is, will you trust me and will you follow me? And as we follow, as imperfectly as we all do, we begin to pick up in a subtle way the skills of the master in the art of spiritual living. And that's just an invitation that God gives to us to come and follow me. The discipleship's always been his way. And that's why he tells these same guys at the end of the Gospels. He says, okay, I've come, I've died for the sins of humanity, I've been raised from the dead to prove that my sacrifice for the sins of humanity was sufficient. Now, your job, what? Go and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them to observe everything that I taught. And I'll be with you, he says, even till the end. And so discipleship is always God's way. And that idea that church is kind of where you come and you take in a bunch of information and then you leave as quickly as possible and forget it the next morning, and then you need to get filled up again the next week or whatever, that's not the Christianity that's described by Jesus and was practiced in the early church. It was all relationally oriented, and it was all about this dynamic process as we do life together. And Jesus is calling these people to a life of purpose. And he's saying, you know, you've been fishermen, and that's great, but now I'm going to call you to something else, to be fishers of people. And this, I think, is a big part of the attraction for these guys. They're attracted by the person of Jesus. They're intrigued by the things that they hear him saying. But then to be looked upon in this way, and for Jesus to say, you come and be about what I'm about. Now they're putting their whole life sort of in perspective. And it's like, you know, fishing's okay. Fishing's not a bad thing to do. Jesus is not down on fishing. He's not down on the relationship that these people have in their families and so forth, the roles that they may occupy in their community. That's all good. But there's something more. And I think that that's a very important part of this. That when Christ calls us to follow him, it's for a purpose. And for a lot of people, and I would definitely include myself here, this is one of the really attractive things about being involved in the Christian life. You know, I want to be able to look back over my life and see that it's of the legacy of God accomplishing something that will last forever. And I think that that's sort of a breathed-in feeling, a passion that people who have come to know God in this way pretty much universally have. It's like, you know, it's so satisfying to know God. And it's so transforming and beautiful to have Him working in our lives. That while I could be involved in any number of good things, this is what I'm really wanting to be about. Real purpose. Involved in things that are greater than myself and that will last beyond my life. Real purpose, real significance. Man, we live in a culture that is just, it's all about the immediate, it's all about experience. But how does it all fit together? What's the thread that holds all of the experiences of life into some sort of a meaningful tapestry? And this is the answer. As we follow Christ, and He accomplishes His will in our lives and through us in various kinds of ways in the world, man, you just begin to develop that sense that my life really does make a difference. That what God is able to accomplish through me really does change the contour of eternity. And that's not just an abstract idea. Man, it shapes and molds your soul. You know, to be involved in things that are significant at this level, it just changes your emotional life. It changes the sharpness of your mind because there's so much to grasp and to apply. It changes the way that you relate to people. And you begin to emerge out of this a profoundly changed individual in a very, very sweet kind of way. And Jesus is calling these guys to this kind of a life of purpose. We may ask ourselves here tonight, you know, what are you fishing for? What's it all about for you? And again, I'm not suggesting that the things that we got to do to get by and the other things that are in our lives, our families and so forth, don't matter. Of course they do. And probably these things occupy a very important part of whatever God's purpose for your life is. But the question that we want to put out here is, when we are seeking real purpose and significance and meaning for our lives, how do we fill in the blank? What's the answer to that question? What makes your life profoundly satisfying in that you've served a purpose that's real and greater than yourself? Now, I would suggest that that's just a built-in human need. All human beings have the need to accomplish things that really matter in a transcendent sort of way. And so here's the invitation. If you follow Jesus Christ, you have that opportunity for Him to shape you and mold you and work through you in ways that will last, you know, forever. And indeed, even the things that just occupy our affections and our time in the present, because they now have a context for a broader meaning and purpose for life, carry on real significance in that sense too. And we find that we have the focus and the energy to be effective as parents and so forth. You know, I look around you know, we have children that are, one's an adult now and the other's in high school. And I think about their friends and the people that they're interacting with. And I think, you know, so many of these kids I feel badly for, because it's like there's nothing above the horizon for them to look at. It's all about present experience. It's all about how do I feel now? And I think, you know, these are the people who are going to become then young adults and middle-aged and move on toward the end. And pretty soon they're going to be scratching their ever-balding heads saying, what's the point? What's the point? And we have an advantage in following Jesus Christ to be able to come along our children and to give them that broad scope about what life can be. And yes, maybe you'll be a fisherman. That's great. But God, you know, God has a call on your life and he wants to accomplish great things through that task, through that place in life and so forth. So I just think that this idea that God calls us to purpose is just so very important. Well, the fact is that they followed, that they sensed that too, these four guys. And what we learn then is that discipleship for them, just like it does for us, requires surrender. It says, yes, I will set aside my nets. And there is real loss there. I'm not going to be able to do the fishing thing like I once did and come home late at night smelling like fish and being all about fish and worms and things of this nature. And to follow Christ then means that we are willing to put our agenda and what we're about under his lordship, under his rule. And we're just basically saying, God, you know, what I'm about is you. And if it's your will that I continue on in these things, that's great. But if you are prepared to move me in a different direction, I am ready to go there as well. And so these guys are out there, and, you know, they didn't know, again, where is this heading? What's it all mean? I think if they knew what was going to happen over the next couple of years, they might have been very reluctant indeed to follow Christ. Don't you think? But they followed. And they began to experience things and see things that would not only rock their world forever, but would absolutely change the whole face of human history down to the present moment. And they were trained and they were used by God and they experienced God powerfully and they were changed by him. Peter did, in fact, become this rock of stability. But it followed from their actions. They were willing to say, I've heard enough, I've seen enough to trust you and to subordinate my agenda to yours and to believe that as I go and do the things that you're about and I'm with you, that my experience, that sense of deep spiritual accomplishment and intimacy with God, of purpose and significance, that will follow from that. And that's always the way it is. And God is saying, I have an offer for you. Will you follow me with your life? And you're saying like, well, okay, I've got reasons to believe that you're there. I believe that this stuff is probably true and stuff, but I don't feel, you know, what is this supposed to be about? What's this supposed to look like? And there's where Jesus says, well, are you ready to trust me on that? You know, some of us are being called by God into very difficult circumstance. The kind of circumstance, for instance, in at home, where with our spouse, God is calling on us to be truth tellers to our wife or our husband, maybe to one of our kids. And we're like, whoa, you know, they might be angry with me. I could get rejected. This could all blow up in my face. Yes, it could. But will you follow me into that relationship, into truth, into reality in that relationship. And trust, yes, I'm with you. And that as a result of our willingness to follow, even when the skies are hazy and we can't really see ahead, what we find is that sure enough, we have learned that God is with us. We do find that he's trustworthy and very sweet, that God does in fact accomplish his purposes through us. It's very satisfying. Very satisfying. But the experience is always going to come after our willingness to trust and to take this kind of action. And then lastly, I think it's very interesting as we look at this paragraph to consider that Jesus is not calling these people merely as individuals. He's not saying, hey, Andrew, come in and have this relationship with me over here. And you, Simon, why don't you come alongside over here? I've got Mondays for you, Andrew. Wednesdays for you, Simon. The Zebedee brothers will divide that between Saturday and Sunday. And so that each of them had their own kind of separate thing with Jesus. Well, that would go over very well in our anal retentive, schedule-driven America. But that's not God's way. And he's like, I'm calling you together as a group of men to come follow me, to be a community together, that we are learners together, and we're going to have that kind of interdependent relationship that learners always have when they're learning an art and doing it well. And I'm just so very thankful that that's always been God's way. He doesn't call us to just have my Jesus thing going. But he calls us into a community of purpose, a community of discipleship. And to me, you know, this is the thing that keeps me sane. I have a pretty loose grip on reality oftentimes. And it's easy for me to get real caught up in my own head. And it's, oh boy, is that a dark place. It's a black hole, really, for me. I realize for many of you, it's all just very delightful and stuff inside, but for me, it's not. And what keeps me able to be focused and to learn this dynamic of trusting Christ with my life, and then beginning to experience his provision, comes in the framework of relationships of other people who were involved in the very same process. I don't think it's possible to follow Christ alone in this world. I know many of you are trying to do just that. You want to swoop in, get a little bit of clarity, and then you want to swoop right on out and continue on with your life the way it is. But we have to understand that is not God's way. God works through community. I'm so thankful for the people in my life over the years, many of whom are here tonight, who were able to sit me down and say, could be wrong, but I think you're really full of it in this area of your life. How offensive. Well, how thankful I am that people are willing to say what they think, are able to call them as they see them, are able to say, you know, maybe God wants to be involved in this issue in your life, that maybe here's a place where you've not set aside your nets to come and follow me. And the community of Christ followers, man, that is reality therapy right there. And it's so strengthening to be able, when I'm at a place in my life where I just feel, you know, I'm not sure what direction I ought to be heading in. Maybe I sense a little distance from God. To be able to look at people that I'm doing life with, brothers and sisters that I care about, who I'm connected with, with whom I've got a track record and some history, and I'm able to look at their lives, and I see with clarity in them what I cannot always see in clarity about myself, which is that we have an awesome and active God. And God is at work. And so there's this vicarious learning that happens through a community of Christ followers. And we've got to have that. Man, if you are here this evening and you know Christ, and you're just sort of isolated out there and you live in your own private world, there's something so beautiful that you're missing. And just the attractiveness of being like-minded with brothers and sisters in Christ who understand you at the deepest level of who you are and with the grace of God accept you and want to build with you is just, that's awesome. There's no substituting, I think, for something like that. And so I just urge you, you know, don't go to your home church. Be a part of the community that is your home church. Get invested. Form those bonds. And that's what it means then to follow Christ. Very attractive. Secondly, Jesus says, and his companions, verse 21, went to the town of Capernaum. This is near Jesus' home in Galilee. And when the Sabbath had come, he went into the synagogue and he began to teach. And the people were amazed at his teaching, for he taught with real authority, quite unlike the teachers of the religious law. And so here's this second kind of window into the magnetic attraction of Christ, namely the attraction of the truth. In contrast to these religious leaders who basically, you know, they had their moral system. And they're like, okay, God has laid down 613 rules in the Old Testament. And they're all there. Do this, don't do that, you know, and so forth. And they thought, you know, that's a good 613 rules. But we can do better. And so they invented thousands of other rules to supplement the 613. And so Judaism, by the time of Christ, was just like, you know, turning people into religious robots who were learning how to act appropriately in all the right circumstances and situations. And it's like, you know, we can do this even if there's not a God. Just follow the rules. And if you follow them better than the next guy, you get the added benefit of being self-righteous. So there's this little competition. But what I'm saying is that religion among the Jews of the first century world in the first century is just so desperately like the religion that is all over the world today, down to the present, even in the name of Christ, which is just a system of morality. It's all just about doing the right thing. And if you can't do the right thing consistently and you can't do it well, then just fake it. You know, just make sure nobody else knows. And this is the icy, irrelevant civil religion that is our day to a very large extent. It's just behavior modification. Trying to make you nice. And, you know, that's the way it was in Jesus' day. And see, he was so not into that. So very different. It says that the people were amazed at his teaching because he taught with real authority. You know, when Jesus spoke, he didn't say, well, the rabbis have agreed that when it says not to work on the Sabbath, what they mean is no spitting, no dragging furniture across your living room, and, you know, and all these other things. And Jesus just spoke very differently. Jesus says, you've heard it said. This is Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard it said, you know, don't do this, don't do that. But I say to you, this thing over here. you have been told, you know, don't commit adultery, don't go out on your spouse. But I say to you, if you have lust in your heart for another, you have committed adultery already. And so Jesus is, and who says? I say, he says. Not Rabbi Ben Hoosie, what's it? I say. And so he's just establishing this level of authority that is beyond all human authority, even beyond the authority of Moses himself. And he says, that's where it's at. He just declares it. And the people are amazed, not only that he would stand in there and make these declarations about himself, but clearly also that they were amazed at the content of his teaching. They were amazed at his teaching. They were hearing in his teaching things that they were not hearing anywhere else. You know, what they were hearing in their teaching was, be good and maybe God will accept you. If you screw up, God's going to get you. And if you've been screwing up, that's evident from the fact that you're sick, that you have this problem or that problem in your life. Those are just evidences of God's judgment on you. And yet in the first kind of full-length sermon that we have of Jesus in Matthew 5 through 7, Jesus says, you know, blessed by God are the poor and the oppressed and so forth. And that just, that rang deeply in the hearts of the people that Jesus is talking to. That truth has an amazing power. And here's something that I want us to understand. That in such a profoundly unique way, Jesus is advancing this message of God's grace, God's unconditioned love for anyone, for all people. And all he's asking us to do, again, as the summary in verse 14 says, is just to turn, recognize I'm a sinful person, I'm guilty before a holy God, and to receive the good news of his forgiveness. And that message, the message that God cares. He cares how much? He cares enough to go into the world that he created, to be rejected by his own creation, and to die for the sins of all of humanity. That's how much he cares for us. And this is what Jesus is teaching, that you don't understand who God is. The love and the mercy, the compassion of God. And this truth had amazing power. Truth has power. And truth, poignantly and forcefully spoken, is the most powerful thing on the earth. Well, I was just thinking about that this fall. And I like history a lot. And I'm especially interested in the cultural developments in our own nation's history over at least the course of my life. And it seems to me that one of the defining moments, the defining issues of truth in our day has been the equality of all people before God. The civil rights movement. And all of us have this image, I suppose, of a Southern Baptist preacher standing in Washington, D.C., declaring the fact that all people are equal before God. And just the profound, nation-shattering reverberations that have come all the way down to the present day. I think that that's very important. Truth has amazing power to change things. And there are other things that we could talk about as well, but I'm just trying to illustrate this idea that bombs can blow stuff up, but truth has the real power. You know, falsehood is a very cruel taskmaster. We live in a very glib culture. We don't care about truth that much, do we? We care about having pleasurable experiences. We kind of prattle on about how, hey, I've got my truth, how about yours? When we realize we're just making it up as we go. There's nothing that's real and objective out there. We're very fragmented in that way. We have no vehicle, no way to kind of come together under something that's real. And falsehood is a cruel taskmaster. Falsehood involves lies that demean human dignity. So we are given messages all over the place. If you matter, you'll look like this. You don't look like that? Well, try this product. If that doesn't work, well, whatever. You don't count. Lies demean human dignity. When you maybe have come to believe that, yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and that's just the way it's going to be for me. That's a lie that demeans your dignity. That's not from God. Lies bind people to their own pride. Lies like the religious lie that says, if I just try hard enough and if I do the right thing and if I'm just sincere enough, that it's going to be okay with me and God. Folks, that's a lie. That's just simply not true. God says that we're all equal partnerships in guilt before Him. It's not a matter that maybe one of us is relatively a little less sinful than the next guy. We're all in the same boat. And yet we want to embrace this idea to keep us in our pride, to make us feel like, see, I'm worthy of God's acceptance because look at all the great things that I've done for Him. That's a lie. That is not what God has said. Lies destroy lives. There's a lie out there that says if you just reach a certain level of success professionally, if you just give yourself wholly to the man, you'll be a success. You'll be happy. You'll be satisfied. Because we all know it's money that makes the world go round, and the more you have of it, the more in control you are. And folks, that's a lie. That's a lie that destroys lives. It destroys the kind of purpose that God could have for your life. And the cost that your family pays as you march merrily into the mayhem and the oblivion of success as our culture defines it. What's for? What for? You just alienated from your spouse, alienated from your kids. It's all screwed up. Falsehood is a cruel taskmaster, and these people that Jesus is addressing, they understand that. They get that. They understand the lies of power as the world understands it. And so that's why he says that the truth will set you free, and that's what Jesus came to do. He came to speak the truth, a truth that transforms as it nourishes our hungry souls. And what Jesus is doing is he's telling the truth. He's presenting good news to oppressed and lost people. And when we are able to be real, and we are able to touch base with the emptiness that is our hearts apart from God, then these words of Christ, that there is good news, is just so very satisfying. so very fulfilling. Oh, I can be forgiven. Oh, I can be reconciled to God and have a means to be reconciled to other people. Oh, I don't have to be the slave of my screwed up character that's brought me to this point, but the future doesn't have to resemble the past. Oh, so astounding. Oh, the attractiveness of what's really true. You know, the truth that Christ presents is truth that reveals that there is the one true God. What we can grope for and never find with our own limited resources, God has done. He's the one who's parted the curtains of eternity and entered into human history and says, here I am. I'm here. This is what I'm about. How powerful. His truth, real truth, gives us practical insight into our life. The words that Jesus utters are life, because as we begin to apply them to our lives, and we have real, and he just gives us piercing insight into ourselves, then we learn in a practical and circumstantial way, what does it mean for me to trust him now in this thing over here? You know, I've got lots of struggles. Relational struggles for me are kind of very high. And I tend to feel deeply invested in a circle of people. And I'm very sensitive often to the thought that the passion that I feel toward them may not be reciprocated. You know what I'm talking about? Anyone else feel that way? You worry about that? I worry about that. And sometimes I get evidence that my suspicions are true. And then I'm like, oh, what am I going to do now? Oh, I know. I'll flip them off and move on. It's just too painful. But then I hear these life-giving words of Christ. Hey, it's more blessed to give than to receive. Hey, how about moving toward a person even in their sinfulness? Because it's really, you know, what's going to make you healthy isn't how they respond to you, but how you respond to them. And there's just a whole warehouse of practical insight that Christ wants to give us, because he's all about the truth. And God made us. He knows us better than anybody else. And so when he speaks in a way that really does, in a direct way, minister to our needs as people. Man, his truth restores perspective and gives us a sense of hope. So these people that Jesus is speaking to, it's just like so refreshing, and they're so attracted that God is pursuing and that God has a way for them. Beautiful. And lastly, verse 23, he says that the last scene here, he says a man was in the synagogue and he was possessed by an evil spirit, and he began to shout, "Why are you interfering with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know you are the Holy One sent from God." And Jesus cut him short and he says, "Shut up. Come out of the man," he ordered. And at that, the evil spirit screamed, threw the man into a convulsion, and then came out of him. Okay, this is where we're going to leave things tonight. This little scene right here. I want to just say a couple things about it. The conclusion is that the amazement gripped the audience, and they began to discuss what had happened, and they say, what sort of new teaching is this? It has such authority. Again, back to that theme, even evil spirits obey his orders. And the news about Jesus spread quickly throughout the entire region of Galilee. So the attraction here is the attraction of real spiritual power. Now, what are we saying here? that this is a demonstration of the truth that he's been proclaiming. This is not just, you know, aphorisms and advice. This is like the truth, and I'm showing you the truth by demonstrating my sovereignty over the spiritual realm itself, this demon-possessed man. And some of you are scratching your heads and saying, huh? What? No, demon possession. That's just the old superstitious pre-scientific world speaking. And I would just suggest here that yes, that's a thought common in the West, pretty rare for the rest. That most of the world doesn't view nature as just a machine. And in most of the world, people are profoundly aware that there are spiritual personalities that animate the world around us. And that they have degrees of influence, even in human beings' lives, and to the point where it is possible under certain circumstances for a person to be taken in possession and controlled by such a spirit. I've seen this myself in India. I've seen it. And it happens in many places around the world. People in most places around the world don't ask, gosh, I wonder if there's a spiritual realm out there. They live in fear of it. They know there is. And this is the world that Jesus is engaging here. And this is our world. Here's what Paul says. He says that there are spiritual forces raised up against the knowledge of God. He says in Ephesians 2, verse 2, that there is a spirit at work in the hearts of those who do not obey God. You know, you sit here tonight and maybe you haven't become a believer in the biblical sense that we've been describing here tonight. And you may say to yourself, you know, but. And it's important for us to understand that there is a native aversion to the good news about Jesus Christ, that he has come to save sinful people. Because that means that I have to exercise the humility to say I need help. Why? It's not that popular. Not in this self-made man society. But I would suggest that there's another piece that we would also want to be sensitive to, and which is the thought that not only do we have our own pride that is a barrier to our really responding to the good news that Christ has to offer to us, but that it's also very possible that we are having also our heart steeled and are being played by spiritual personalities who every time we're hearing about this grace thing, we just want to go, ew, cringe, ugh, this inexplicable sort of to the good news about Christ. It just seems odious. We don't know why. It just seems, ugh. And the Bible says that we have genuine spiritual opposition to God. And that opposition, those evil spiritual beings, they resist God. And they have an ability to lie, to accuse, a whole range of things to delude us from that palpable sense of need to respond to the good things that God has for us. And to me, that's valuable to consider here. Because as we are engaging with the gospel of Christ to our friends, we have to understand that, yes, our friends have to make some free will decisions, but there is also competition for their hearts. That prayer really does matter. That engaging the reality that there is opposition matters. And that's why God calls on us to pray and to be sensitive to these things, because they really are there. not to be spooked or to create fanciful images of devils in long underwear and pitchforks and stuff like that, but that there are real personalities that have the capacity to speak to our minds and say, and we listen to those voices. Well, this is something to end on there. Jesus says, I've got power over that. Why don't you turn the discussion to me? Why don't you come before me and say, you know, the thought of knowing you is a very desirable one indeed. And to the extent that there are spiritual beings vying for my heart, I ask in the name of Christ that you put those aside so that I can be free to move toward you. Well, the consequence, very awesome. News of Christ spreads all over the place. An incredible movement begins. Let's just draw the line there. We're going to come back and we're going to look at a series of episodes the next time we meet over Mark.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.